design, and a panel of local worthies convened to select a winner. Unable to reach a consensus, the judges sought the opinion of the Finnish-born American architect Eero Saarinen, who sifted through the offerings and selected a design that the jurors had rejected. It was by a little-known 37-year-old Danish architect named Jørn Utzon. Possibly to the panel's relief, certainly to its credit, it deferred to Saarinen's opinion, and Utzon was cabled with the news. The plan, in the words of John Gunther, was bold, unique, brilliantly chosen, and trouble from its inception. The problem was the famous roof. Nothing so daringly inclined and top-heavy had ever been built before, and no one was sure that it could be. In retrospect, the haste with which the project was begun was probably its salvation. One of the lead engineers later noted that if anyone had realized at the outset how nearly impossible a challenge it would be, it would never have gotten the go-ahead. Just working out the principles necessary to build the roof took 5 years. The whole project had been intended to last no more than 6, and construction in the end dragged on for almost a decade and a half. The final cost came in at a weighty 102 million Australian dollars, 14 times the original estimate. Utzon, interestingly, has never seen his prized creation. He left the project in 1966 in a huff over artistic differences and has never been back. He also never designed anything remotely as celebrated. His other main projects were all in Denmark, a church in suburban Copenhagen, and housing estates in Helsingør and Fredensborg. Goossens, the man who started it all, likewise failed to see his dream realized. In 1956, while passing through customs at Sydney Airport, he was found to be carrying a large and diversified collection of pornographic material, and he was invited to take his sordid continental habits elsewhere. Thus, by one of life's small ironies, he was unable to enjoy, as it were, his own finest erection. The Opera House is a splendid edifice, and I wish to take nothing away from it, but my heart belongs to the Harbour Bridge. It's not as festive, but it is far more dominant. You can see it from every corner of the city, creeping into frame from the oddest angles, like an uncle who wants to get into every snapshot. From a distance it has a kind of gallant restraint, majestic but not assertive, but up close it is all might. It soars above you, so high that you could pass a 10-story building beneath it, and looks like the heaviest thing on earth. Everything that is in it, the stone blocks in its 4 towers, the latticework of girders, the metal plates, the 6 million rivets with heads like halved apples, is the biggest of its type you have ever seen. This is a bridge built by people who have had an industrial revolution, people with mountains of coal and ovens in which you could melt down a battleship. The arch alone weighs 30,000 tons. This is a great bridge. From end to end, it stretches 1,650 feet. I mention this not just because I was walking every foot of it now, but because there is a certain poignancy in the figure. In 1923, when the city burghers decided to throw a bridge across the harbor, they determined to build not just any bridge, but the longest single arch span ever constructed. It was a bold enterprise for a young country, and it took longer to construct than expected, almost 10 years. Just before it was completed, in 1932, the Bayonne Bridge in New York quietly opened and was found to be 25 inches, 0.121%, longer. After such a long spell in an airplane, I was eager to stretch my shapely limbs, so I crossed the bridge to Kirribilli and plunged into the old, cozily settled neighborhoods of the North Shore. And what a wonderful area it is. I wandered past the little cove where my hero, the aviator Charles Kingsford Smith, about whom, much more anon, once impossibly took off in an airplane, and into the shaded hills above, through quiet neighborhoods of cottagey homes buried in flowering jacaranda and fragrant frangipani, and in every front garden cobwebs like trampolines, in the center of each the sort of spider that would make a brave man gasp. At every turn there was a glimpsed view of Blue Harbor, over a garden wall, at the bottom of a sloping road, suspended between close-set houses like a sheet hung to dry, and it was all the finer for being furtive. Sydney has whole districts filled with palatial houses that seem to consist of nothing but balconies and plate glass, with scarcely a leaf to block the beating sun or interrupt the view, But here on the North Shore, wisely and nobly, they have sacrificed large-scale vistas for the cool shade of trees, and every resident will, I guarantee, go to heaven. I walked for miles, through Kirribilli, Neutral Bay, and Cremorne Point, and on through the prosperous precincts of Mossman, before at last I came to Balmoral, with a sheltered beach overlooking Middle Harbour, and a splendid waterfront park shaded with stout Moreton Bay figs, the loveliest tree in Australia by far. A sign by the water's edge noted that if you were eaten by sharks, it wasn't because you hadn't been warned. Apparently, shark attacks are much more likely inside the harbour than out. I don't know why. I had also read in Jan Morris's engaging and cheery book, Sydney, that the harbour teems with lethal goblin fish. What is notable about this is that in all my reading, I never came across a single other reference to these rapacious creatures. This isn't to suggest, I hastily add, that Ms. Morris was being inventive, merely that it isn't possible in a single lifetime to read about all the dangers that lurk under every wattle bush or ripple of water in this wondrously venomous and toothy country. These thoughts took on a certain relevance some hours later, in the dry heat of afternoon, when I returned to the city, dog-tired and pasted with sweat, and impulsively popped into the grand and brooding Australian Museum in its setting beside Hyde Park. I went not because it is fabulous, but because I was half-crazed from the heat, and it looked to be one of those old buildings that are dim-lit and gratifyingly cool inside. It was both of those, and fabulous as well. It is a vast and old-fashioned place. I mean that as the most admiring compliment. I know of no higher for a museum, with lofty galleried halls full of stuffed animals and long cases of carefully mounted insects, chunks of luminous minerals, or aboriginal artifacts. In a country such as Australia, every room is a wonder. As you can imagine, I was particularly attracted to all those things that might hurt me, which in an Australian context is practically everything. It really is the most extraordinarily lethal country. Naturally, they play down the fact that every time you set your feet on the floor, something is likely to jump out and seize an ankle. Thus, my guidebook blandly observed that only 14 species of Australian snakes are seriously lethal, among them the western brown, desert death adder, tiger snake, taipan, and yellow-bellied sea snake. The taipan is the one to watch out for. It is the most poisonous snake on earth, with a lunge so swift and a venom so potent that your last mortal utterance is likely to be, "I say, is that a s—" Even from across the room, you could see at once which was the display case containing the stuffed taipan, for it had around it a clutch of small boys held in rapt silence by the frozen gaze of its beady, lazily hateful eyes. You can kill it and stuff it and put it in a case, but you can't take away the menace. According to the label, the taipan carries a venom 50 times more deadly than that of the cobra, its next nearest challenger. Amazingly, just one fatal attack is on record, at Mildura in 1989. But we knew the real story, my attentive little friends and I, that once you leave this building, the taipans aren't stuffed and behind glass. At least the taipan is 5 feet long and thick as a man's wrist, which gives you a reasonable chance of spotting it. What I found far more appalling was the existence of lethal small snakes, like the little desert death adder. Just 8 inches long, it lies lightly buried in soft sand, so that you have no hope of seeing it before setting your weary butt on its head. Even more worrying was the Point Darwin sea snake, which is not much larger than an earthworm, but packs enough venom, if not to kill you, at least to make you very late for dinner. But all of these are as nothing compared with the delicate and diaphanous box jellyfish, the most poisonous creature on earth. We will hear more of the unspeakable horrors of this little bag of lethality when we get to the tropics, but let me offer here just one small story. In 1992, a young man in Cairns, ignoring all the warning signs, went swimming in the Pacific waters at a place called Holloway's Beach. He swam and dove, taunting his friends on the beach for their prudent cowardice, and then began to scream with an inhuman sound. It is said that there is no pain to compare with it. The young man staggered from the water, covered in livid whip-like stripes wherever the jellyfish's tentacles had brushed across him, and collapsed in quivering shock. Soon afterward, emergency crews arrived, inflated him with morphine, and took him away for treatment. And here's the thing. Even unconscious and sedated, he was still screaming. Sydney has no box jellyfish, I was pleased to learn. The famous local danger is the funnel web spider, the most poisonous insect in the world, with a venom that is highly toxic and fast-acting. A single nip, if not promptly treated, will leave you bouncing around in the grip of seizures of an incomparable liveliness. Then you turn blue, then you die. 13 deaths are on record, though none since 1981, when an antidote was devised. Also poisonous are white-tailed spiders, mouse spiders, wolf spiders, our old friend the redback, hundreds of bites are reported each year, about a dozen known deaths, and a reclusive but fractious type called the fiddleback. I couldn't say for sure whether I had seen any of these in the gardens I had passed earlier in the day, but then I couldn't say I hadn't, since they all looked essentially the same. No one knows, incidentally, why Australia spiders are so extravagantly toxic. Capturing small insects and injecting them with enough poison to drop a horse would appear to be the most literal case of overkill. Still, it does mean that everyone gives them lots of space. I studied with particular alertness the funnel web, since this was the creature that I was most likely to encounter in the next few days. It was about an inch and a half long, plump, hairy, and ugly. According to the label, you can identify a funnel web by the mating organ on the male palp, deeply curved fovea, shiny carapace, and lower labium studded with short, blunt spines. Alternatively, of course, you can just let it sting you. I carefully copied all this down before it occurred to me that if I were to awake to find any large, furry creature advancing crab-like across the sheets, I was unlikely to note any of its anatomical features, however singular and telling. So I put away my notebook and went off to look at minerals, which aren't so exciting, but do have the compensating virtue that almost never will they attack you. I spent 4 days wandering around Sydney. I visited the principal museums with dutiful absorption and spent an afternoon in the admirably welcoming State Library of New South Wales, but mostly I just wandered wherever there was water. Without question, it is the harbour that makes Sydney. It's not so much a harbour as a fjord, 16 miles long and perfectly proportioned, big enough for grandeur, small enough to have a neighbourly air. Wherever you stand, the people on the far shore are almost never so distant as to seem remote. Often you could hail them if you wished. Because it runs through the heart of the city from east to west, it divides Sydney into more or less equal halves, known as the northern and eastern suburbs. And never mind that the eastern suburbs are actually in the south, or that many of the northern suburbs are decidedly eastern. Australians, never forget, started life as Britons. To note that it is 16 miles long barely hints at its extent. Because it constantly wanders off into arms that finish in the serenest little coves, the most gently scalloped bays, the harbour shoreline actually extends to 152 miles. The consequence of this wandering nature is that one moment you are walking beside a tiny sheltered cove that seems miles from anywhere, and the next you round a headland to find before you an open expanse of water, with the Opera House and Harbour Bridge and clustered skyscrapers gleaming in airy sunshine and holding center stage. It is endlessly and unbelievably beguiling. On my last day, I hiked out to Hunter's Hill, a treasured and secretive district about 6 miles from downtown, on a long finger of land overlooking one of the quieter inner reaches of the harbour. I chose it because Jan Morris had made it sound so delightful in her book. I dare say she reached it by water, as any sensible person would. I decided to walk out along Victoria Road, which may not be the ugliest road in Australia, but must be the least agreeable to walk along. I strode for shadeless miles through zones of factories, warehouses, and railway lines, then miles more of marginal commercial districts, of discount furnishers, industrial wholesalers, and dingy pubs offering surreally unappealing inducements. Meat raffles, 6 to 8 p.m. By the time I reached a small sign pointing down a side road to Hunter's Hill, my expectations were flagging. Imagine then my satisfaction at discovering that Hunter's Hill was worth every steaming step. A lovely hidden borough of plump stone mansions, pretty cottages, and picturesquely clustered shops of an often impressive venerability. There was a small but splendid town hall dating from 1860, and a chemist shop that had been in business since 1890, which must be a record in Australia. Every garden was a treasure, and somewhere in almost every backdrop lurked a glimpse of harbour view. I could not have been more charmed. Reluctant to retrace my steps, I decided to push on farther, through Linley Point, Lane Cove, Northwood, Greenwich, and Wollstonecraft, and rejoin the known world at the harbour bridge. It was a long way around, and the day was sultry, but Sydney is a constantly rewarding place, and I was feeling ambitious. I suppose I walked for about an hour before it dawned on me that this was actually quite ambitious. I had barely penetrated Linley Point and was still miles from downtown, but then I noticed on the map what appeared to be a worthwhile shortcut through a place called Tennyson Park. I followed a side road down a residential street, and about halfway along came to the entrance to the park. A wooden sign announced that what lay beyond was preserved bushland, and politely requested users not to stray from the path. Well, this seemed a splendid notion, an expansive native bush in the heart of a great city, and I ventured in eagerly. I don't know what image bush conjures up in your mind, but this was not the brown and semi-barren tract I would have expected, but a wooded glade with a sun-dappled path and tinkling brook. It appeared to be scarcely used. Every few yards I would have to duck under or walk around big spider-webs strung across the path, which lent the whole enterprise a sense of lucky discovery. I guessed it would take about 20 minutes to cut through the park, or the reserve, as Australians call these things, and I was probably about halfway along when, from an indeterminate distance off to the right, there came the bark of a dog, tentative and experimental, as if to say, "Who's that?" It wasn't very close or intimidating, but it was clearly the bark of a big dog. Something in its timbre said, "Meat-eater, black, very big, not too many generations removed from wolf." Almost in the same instant it was joined by the bark of a companion dog, also big, and this bark was decidedly less experimental. This bark said, "Red alert, trespasser on our territory." Within a minute they had worked themselves up into a considerable frenzy. Nervously I quickened my pace. Dogs don't like me. It is a simple law of the universe, like gravity. I am not exaggerating when I say that I have never passed a dog that didn't act as if it thought I was about to take its alpo. Dogs that have not moved from the sofa in years will, at the sniff of me passing outside, rise in gorge and hurl themselves at shut windows. I have seen tiny dogs, no bigger than Fluffy Slipper, jerk little old ladies off their feet and drag them over open ground in a quest to get at my blood and sinew. Every dog on the face of the earth wants me dead. And now here I was, alone in an empty woods, which suddenly seemed very large and lonely, and two big and angry-sounding dogs had me in their sights. As I pushed on, two things became increasingly apparent. I was definitely the target, and these dogs were not messing around. They were coming toward me at some speed. Now the barking said, "We are going to have you, boy. You are dead meat. You are small, pulpy pieces." You will note the absence of exclamation marks. Their barks were no longer tinged with lust and frenzy. They were statements of cold intent. "We know where you are," they said. "You cannot make it to the edge of the woods. We will be with you shortly. Somebody call forensics." Casting worried glances at the foliage, I began to trot and then to run. It was now time to consider what I would do if the dogs burst onto the path. I picked up a rock for defense, then discarded it a few yards farther on for a stick that was lying across the path. The stick was ludicrously outsized. It must have been 12 feet long, and so rotted that it fell in half just from being picked up. As I ran, it lost another half, and another, until finally it was no more than a soft, spongy stub. It would have been like defending myself with a loaf of bread. So I threw it down and picked up a big jagged rock in each hand and quickened my pace yet again. The dogs now seemed to be moving parallel to me, as if they couldn't find a way through, but at a distance of no more than 40 or 50 yards. They were furious. My unease expanded, and I began to run a little faster. In my stumbling haste, I rounded a bend too fast and ran headlong into a giant spider's web. It fell over me like a collapsing parachute. Ululating in dismay, I tore at the cobwebs, but with rocks in my hands only succeeded in banging myself in the forehead. In a small, lucid corner of my brain, I remember thinking, this really is very unfair. Somewhere else was the thought, you are going to be the first person in history to die in the bush in the middle of a city, you poor sad schlub. All the rest was icy terror. And so I trotted along, wretched and whimpering, until I rounded a bend and found, with another small and disbelieving wail, that the path abruptly terminated. Before me stood nothing but impenetrable tangle, a wall of it. I looked around, astounded and appalled. In my panic, doubtless while I was scraping the cobwebs from my brow with the aid of lumps of granite, I had evidently taken a wrong turn. In any case, there was no way forward, and nothing behind but a narrow path leading back in the direction of two surging streaks of malice. Glancing around in desperation, I saw with unconfined joy, at the top of a 20-foot rise, a corner of rotary clothesline. There was a home up there. I had reached the edge of the park, albeit from an unconventional direction. No matter. There was a civilized world up there. Safety. I scrambled up the hill as fast as my plump little pins would carry me. The dogs were very close now, snagging myself on thorns, inhaling cobwebs, straining with every molecule of my being not to become a headline that said, "Police find rider's torso, head still missing." At the top of the hill stood a brick wall perhaps 6 feet high. Grunting extravagantly, I hauled myself onto its flat summit and dropped down on the other side. The transformation was immediate, the relief sublime. I was back in the known world, in someone's much-loved backyard. There was a set of old swings that didn't look as if they had been used in some years. Flower beds, a lawn leading to a patio. The garden appeared to be fully enclosed, by brick wall on three sides, and a big comfortable-looking house on the fourth, which I hadn't quite anticipated. I was trespassing, of course, but there wasn't any way I was going back into those woods. Part of the view was obscured by a shed or summer house. With luck, there would be a gate beyond, and I could let myself out and slip back into the world undetected. My most immediate concern was that there might be a big, mean dog in here as well. Wouldn't that be richly ironic? With this in mind, I crept cautiously forward. Now let us change the point of view just for a moment. Forgive me for getting you up, but I need to put you at the window beside the kitchen sink of this tranquil suburban home. You are a pleasant middle-aged homemaker going about your daily business, at this particular moment filling a vase with water to hold some peonies you've just cut from the bed by the drawing-room windows, and you see a man drop over your back wall and begin to move in a low crouch across your backyard. Frozen with fear and a peculiar detached fascination, you are unable to move, but just stand watching as he advances stealthily across the property in a commando posture, with short, frenzied dashes between covering objects, until he has crouched beside a concrete urn at the edge of your patio, only about 10 feet away. It is then that he notices you staring at him. "Oh, hello," says the man cheerfully, straightening up and smiling in a way that he thinks looks sincere and ingratiating, but in fact merely suggests someone who has failed to take his medication. Almost at once, your thoughts go to a police mugshot you saw in the evening paper earlier in the week, pertaining, if you recall, to a breakout at an institution for the criminally insane at Wollongong. "Sorry to crash in on you like this," the man is saying, "but I was desperate. Did you hear all the racket? I thought they were going to kill me." He beams foolishly and waits for you to reply, but you say nothing because you are powerless to speak. Your eyes slide over to the open back door. If you both moved for it now, you would arrive together. All kinds of thoughts start to run through your head. "I didn't actually see them," the man goes on, in a judicious but oddly pumped-up tone, "but I know they were after me." He looks as if he has been living rough. Smudges of dirt rim his face, and one of his pant legs is torn at the knee. "They always go for me," he says, earnest now, and puzzled. "It's as if there's some kind of conspiracy to get me. I can be just walking down the street, you know, minding my own business, and suddenly from out of nowhere they just come for me. It's very unsettling." He shakes his head. "Is your gate unlocked?" You haven't been listening to any of this, because your hand has been moving almost imperceptibly toward the drawer containing the steak knives. As the question dawns on you, you find yourself giving a small, tight, almost involuntary nod. "I'll just let myself out then. Sorry to have disturbed you." At the gate he pauses. Take it from me, he says. You don't ever want to go back in those woods alone. Something terrible could happen to you back there. I love your delphiniums, by the way. He smiles in a way that freezes your marrow and says, well, bye then. And he is gone. 6 weeks later, you put the house on the market. Chapter 5. When Australians get hold of a name that suits them, they tend to stick with it in a big way. We can blame this unfortunate custom on Lachlan Macquarie, a Scotsman who was governor of the colony in the first part of the 19th century, and whose principal achievements were the building of the Great Western Highway through the Blue Mountains, the popularizing of Australia as a name. Before him, the whole country was indifferently referred to as either New South Wales or Botany Bay, and the world's first nearly successful attempt to name every object on a continent after himself. You really cannot move in Australia without bumping into some reminder of his tenure. Run your eye over the map, and you will find a Macquarie Harbour, Macquarie Island, Macquarie Marsh, Macquarie River, Macquarie Fields, Macquarie Pass, Macquarie Plains, Lake Macquarie, Port Macquarie, Mrs. Macquarie's Chair, a lookout point over Sydney Harbour, Macquarie's Point, and a Macquarie Town. I always imagine him sitting at his desk, poring over maps and charts with a magnifying glass, and calling out from time to time to his first assistant, "Hey, we no got a Macquarie swamp yet, laddie. And look here at this wee copse. It has nae name. What shall we call it, do you think?" And that's just some of the Macquaries, by the way. Macquarie is also the name of a bank, a leading university, the National Dictionary, a shopping center, an ice rink, and one of Sydney's principal streets. That's not to mention the 47 other roads, avenues, groves, and terraces in Sydney that, according to Jan Morris, are named for the man or his family. Nor have we touched on the Lachlan River, Lachlan Valley, or any of the other first-name variations that sprang to his tireless mind. You wouldn't suppose there would be much left after all that, but one of Macquarie's successors as governor, Ralph Darling, managed to get his name all over the place, too. In Sydney you will find a Darling Harbour, Darling Drive, Darling Island, Darling Point, Darlinghurst, and Darlington. Elsewhere, Darling's modest achievements are remembered in the Darling Downs and Darling Ranges, a slew of additional Darlingtons, and the important Darling River. What isn't called Darling or Macquarie is generally called Hunter or Murray. It's awfully confusing. Even when the names aren't exactly the same, they are often very similar. There is a Cape York Peninsula in the far north, and a York Peninsula in the far south. Two of the leading explorers of the 19th century were called Sturt and Stuart, and their names are all over the place, too, so that you must constantly stop and think, generally at busy intersections where an instant decision is required. Now, did I want the Sturt Highway or the Stuart Highway? Since both highways start at Adelaide and finish at places 3,994 kilometers apart, this can make a difference. I was thinking about all this, the confusion of place names and monuments to Lachlan Macquarie, the following morning because I spent much of it in the grip of the first while in pursuit of the second. I was in a rental car, you see, trying to find my way out of the endless, bewildering sprawl of Sydney. According to the local telephone directory, there are 784 suburbs and other named districts in the city, and I believe I passed through every one of them as I sought in vain for a corner of Australia not covered by bungalows. Some neighborhoods I visited twice, at opposite ends of the morning. For a time, I thought about just abandoning the car at the curb in Parramatta. I rather liked the name, and people were beginning to wave to me familiarly. But eventually I shot out of the city, like a spat bug, pleased to find myself on the correct heading for Lithgow, Bathurst, and points beyond, and filled with that sense of giddy delight that comes with finding yourself at large in a new and unknown continent. My intention over the next couple of weeks was to wander through what I think of as civilized Australia, the lower right-hand corner of the country, extending from Brisbane in the north to Adelaide in the south and west. This area covers perhaps 5% of the nation's land surface, but contains 80% of its people and nearly all its important cities, specifically Brisbane, Sydney, Melbourne, Canberra, and Adelaide. In the whole of the vast continent, this is pretty much the only part that is conventionally habitable. Because of its curving shape, it is sometimes called the Boomerang Coast, though in fact my interest was largely internal. I was headed in the first instance for Canberra, the nation's interesting, park-like, and curiously much-scorned capital. Thence I would cross 800 miles of lonely interior to distant Adelaide, before finally fetching up, dusty but ever indomitable, in Melbourne, where I was to meet some old friends, who would hose me down and take me off for a long-promised tour of the snake-infested, little-visited, but gorgeously rewarding Victorian bush. There was much to see along the way. I was very excited. But first I had to make my way through the Blue Mountains, the scenic and long impassable hills lying just to Sydney's west. On approach, the Blue Mountains don't look terribly challenging. They rise to no great height, and everywhere wear a cloak of softening green. But in fact, they are rent with treacherous gorges and bouldered canyons, some with walls rising sheer hundreds of feet. And that lovely growth proves on closer inspection to be of an unusually tangled and obscuring nature. For the first quarter of a century of European occupation, the Blue Mountains stood as an impenetrable barrier to expansion. Expeditions tried repeatedly to find a way through, but were always turned back. Even if progress could be gained through the lacerating undergrowth, it was nearly impossible to maintain one's bearings amid the wandering gorges. Watkin Tench, a leader of one party, reported with understandable exasperation how he and his men struggled for hours to find a route to the top of one impossibly taxing defile, only to discover when they attained the summit that they were exactly opposite where they expected to be. Finally, in 1813, three men, Gregory Blaxland, William Charles Wentworth, and William Lawson, broke through. Exhausted, tattered, and ill with bowel complaints, as Wentworth glumly noted, then and on any occasion that anyone would listen for the rest of his long life. It had taken them 18 days, but as they stepped onto the airy heights of Mount York, they were rewarded with a view of pastoral splendor never before seen by Europeans in Australia. Below them, for as far as the gaze could reach, stretched a sunny golden Eden, a continent of grass, enough to support a population of millions. Australia would be a mighty country. The news, when they returned to Sydney, was electrifying. In less than 2 years, a road was cut through the wilderness, and the westward peopling of Australia had begun. Today, the Great Western Highway, as it is grandly and romantically known, follows almost exactly the route taken by Blaxland and his companions nearly 200 years ago. It certainly feels venerable. The route goes up and through the mountains, and for much of the way passes along such confined spaces that there is no room for a big modern road. So the Great Western has the tight bends and unyielding width of a road designed for an age when motorists clapped goggles over their eyes and started their cars with a crank. I'd been through here not long before on the Indian Pacific, but the views from the train weren't good. Glimpsed vistas seen through a picket fence of gum trees, and then, each time, an abrupt veering away into denser woodland. And anyway, I had been preoccupied with exploring the train. So I was eager now to see the mountains up close, in particular the famous dreamy views from the little town of Katoomba. Alas, luck was not with me. As I followed the tortuous road up into the distant hills, the windshield became speckled with drizzle, and a chill, swirling fog began to fill the spaces between the coachwood and sassafras trees that loomed up on every side. Very quickly the fog thickened to the density of wood smoke. I had never been out in such fog. Within minutes it was like piloting a small plane through cloud. There was a hood in front of me, and then just white. It was all I could do to keep the car affixed to its lane. The road was almost preposterously narrow and twisting, and with the visibility so low, every sudden curve was received with a whoop of surprise. At length I reached Katoomba, where the fog was, if anything, worse. The town was reduced to spooky shapes that loomed out of the murk from time to time, like frights at a carnival ride. Twice, at no more than 2 miles an hour, I nearly drove into the backs of parked cars. I have no idea why I bothered, but having come this far, I found my way to a lookout spot called Echo Point, parked, and got out. Not surprisingly, I was the only person there. I went and grasped the railing and gazed out, the way you do at a lookout point. Before me there stood nothing but depthless white, and that peculiar twitchy stillness that fog brings. To my surprise, from out of the milky vapors there emerged an elderly couple, dapper and doddery, and bundled up as if for a long winter. The man walked with a particularly unsteady gait, propped by a cane on one side, and his wife on the other. As they drew level, he looked at me in surprise. "You won't see anything today," he barked, as if I was wasting his time as well as my own. I guessed from the volume that he might be a little deaf. "This won't clear for 36 hours." More confidingly, he added, "Depression over the Pacific often happens." He nodded sagely and joined me in contemplating the nothingness. His wife gave me a tiny smile that was at once apologetic, long-suffering, and a little wistful. "It might clear after a bit," she speculated hopefully. He looked at her as if she had just announced an intention to have a shit on the pavement. "Clear? It's never going to clear. There's a depression over the Pacific." He looked for a moment as if he might swipe her with his cane. Her optimism was not lightly deflected, however. "Don't you remember how it came out all lovely that time at Bunbury?" she said. "Bunbury," he replied incredulously. "Bunbury? That's the other side of the country. It's a different bloody ocean. What are you talking about? You're mad. You want putting away." Suddenly I recognized the accent. He was a Yorkshireman, or at least once had been. "It didn't look like it was going to turn out fine," she went on to me, expecting a more sympathetic hearing, "and then it did turn out. It's a different ocean, woman. Are you deaf as well as mad?" It was clear that this was, at least in the fundamentals, a conversation that they had been having for years. "You get a quite different set of meteorological conditions in the Indian Ocean. Quite different. Any fool knows that." He was quiet for half a second and then said, "I thought we were going for a cup of tea." "We are, dear," she replied. "I just thought we'd have a little stroll." Deftly, she set him in motion again. "A stroll? What for? There's bugger all to see. Are you blind as well as deaf and mad? This won't clear for 36 hours. "I know, dear, but..." Within moments, they were just voices floating out of a veil of white, and then they were gone altogether. Reluctant to leave the area, I spent the night in Blackheath, a pretty little town in the woods a dozen miles farther down the highway. My last view from my motel window before turning in was of a car passing slowly on the highway, its headlamps like searchlights, and the world settled under a thick eiderdown of murk. It didn't look terribly promising. So you may imagine my surprise when I awoke in the morning to find bright sunshine spilled across my bed and filling the tops of the trees outside. I opened the door to a golden world so bright it made me blink. Birds were singing in the exotic tones of the bush. I wasted not a moment getting back to Katoomba. The view when I returned to Echo Point was outstanding, a broad veil of very green forest broken at intervals by square-topped outcrops and fractured pinnacles, the whole filled with a vast and imposing silence. The sky was a rich and all but cloudless blue. Even at 9 in the morning, you could tell it was going to be a really hot day. I spent 90 minutes or so walking along the cliff top, enjoying the view from various angles. I had a look at Katoomba Falls, and the stranded sandstone uprights known as the Three Sisters, and at length, entirely satisfied, wandered back into town for coffee. In the 1930s and 1940s, Katoomba was a popular retreat for people of a genteel and discriminating nature. It was much less raffish than Bondi or the other beach outposts, where there was always the danger that young Bruce and Noel Lean might be exposed to more flesh than was healthy at their ages, or overhear strong language, men saying Jeezums and Struth and so on. Katoomba offered more refined pursuits. Strolls through the woods, a therapeutic dip in a hydro pool, orchestral dancing in the evenings. Today Katoomba clings, with a slight air of desperation, to its bygone glory. Its main street had a generous sprinkling of Art Deco buildings, notably a wonderful old movie house, though several, including the movie house, were closed. I bought a morning newspaper and found my way into a cafe. It always amazes me how seldom visitors bother with local papers. Personally, I can think of nothing more exciting, certainly nothing you could do in a public place with a cup of coffee, than to read newspapers from a part of the world you know almost nothing about. What a comfort it is to find a nation preoccupied by matters of no possible consequence to oneself. I love reading about scandals involving ministers of whom I have never heard, murder hunts in communities whose names sound dusty and remote, features on revered artists and thinkers whose achievements have never reached my ears, whose talents I must take on faith. I love above all to venture into the color supplements and see what's fashionable for the beach in this part of the world, what's new for the kitchen, what I might get for my money if I had 400,000 Australian dollars and a reason to live in Dubbo or Woolloomooloo. There is something about all this that feels privileged, almost illicit, like going through a stranger's drawers. Where else can you get this much pleasure for a trifling handful of coins? At this time, I was following with some devotion a libel trial in which two government ministers were suing a publisher over a book containing scurrilous and, as it proved, groundless allegations implying sexual indiscretions in times gone by. With each passing day, the trial had taken on the most exhilarating air of farce. Just recently, the former leader of the opposition had taken the stand and, for no reason that any sane person could deduce, had begun recounting lively stories of alleged sexual improprieties by other ministers who were not remotely connected to the book or trial. But what had attracted me to the case in the first place, and what made it all seem particularly special, was the simple happy coincidence that the two ministers at the heart of the affair were named Abbott and Costello. So I was sitting happily absorbed in this when I heard a familiar voice say, quite loudly and in a discontented tone, "This isn't strawberry jam, it's blackcurrant." I looked up to see my two little old friends from the day before. They were looking much smaller and frailer with their hats and coats and scarves off. These items, neatly folded, were stacked high on the chairs beside them, as if awaiting transfer to a linen cupboard. I wondered if perhaps they wore all those clothes, not so much for warmth, as because all the dressing and undressing helped them fill their days. "They haven't got strawberry, dear," said the wife in a quieter voice. The lady explained, "They only have blackcurrant or marmalade." "Well, I don't want either." "Well, then don't have either," this said with just a hint of weariness. "But it's on my toast." "No, dear, that's my toast. I ordered you a jam donut."
"Jam donut? Jam donut? Are you mad? I don't like jam donuts. This tea is cold."
I lowered myself back into my paper, but on the way out I stopped to bid my elderly friends good day. The man clearly didn't have any very real notion who I was. The jam donut, I noticed, had been devoured. Only a small purple dollop gleamed on the plate before him. "It's the young man from Echo Point," the woman explained, but her husband was too busy chasing the dollop of jam with a spoon to pay me any heed. "I see the weather's cleared," I observed cheerfully.
"Often happens like that," the man said in a small shout, without looking up. "I said it wouldn't last 36 hours.
"We had an experience just like it at Bunbury once," the wife said to me. "Terrible fog, and then all of a sudden it came out all lovely and clear. Do you remember that, dear?"
"Quite," said the old man, distractedly. Coaxing the elusive jam aboard with a forefinger, he lifted the spoon and bunged it in his mouth with a look of immense satisfaction. "Quite." And so once more to the wandering road. Beyond Blackheath, the highway began a steep and curvaceous descent toward Lithgow, where it skirted along the hem of the mountains before striking off cross-country through grassy plains, toward the country town of Bathurst. I was now in the rural heartlands, in an area known to geology as the Murray-Darling Basin. The fields on all sides were filled with tall blonde grass, which waved in a languid manner, and there were buttercups in the verges, the whole bathed in the sweetest, brightest sunlight. Here and there stately trees shaded a white farmhouse. There wasn't a gum tree in sight. I could almost have been in the American Midwest. The welcoming world I was passing into now wasn't quite as virginal as Blaxland and his cronies had supposed when they first gazed down on it from the heights behind me. When the first settlers stepped from the wooded mountains, they were startled to find herds of cows, numbering in the hundreds, grazing contentedly on the tall grasses, all offspring of the ones that had wandered off from Sydney Cove all those years before. The cows, it transpired, had gone around the mountains, through an open pass to the south. Why it had not occurred to a human being in 25 years to try to do likewise is a question that is rarely asked and has yet to be satisfactorily answered. Nor were the fertile plains quite as boundless as had at first been supposed. Good grazing land extended only a few score miles inland from the coast, and even that was subject to the dispiriting vagaries of nature. It still is. 100 miles or so north of where I was driving now, on the edge of this grassy zone, stands the little town of Ningen. In 1989, 1990, 1992, 1995, 1996, and 1998, it was devastated by torrential flash floods.
For 5 years during this same period, while Ningen was repeatedly inundated, the town of Kobar, just 80 miles to the west, recorded not a drop of rain. This is, if I haven't made it clear already, one tough country. And yet the striking thing about this area was how thoroughly delightful and accommodating it appeared. The farms were neat and trim, and the towns I passed through gave every air of a comfortable prosperity. It was impossible to believe that a metropolis of 4 million people lay just over the hills behind. I felt as if I had stumbled into some forgotten, magically self-contained world. There were things out here I hadn't seen in years. Gas stations with old-fashioned pumps and no canopies over the forecourt, so that you pumped your gas in full sun, as I am sure God intended it. Metal windmills of the sort that used to stand in every Kansas farm field. Little towns with people in them. People going about their business, greeting each other with a smile and a nod. It all had a familiarity about it, but the familiarity of something half forgotten. Gradually it dawned on me that I was in the American Midwest, but it was the American Midwest of long ago. I was, in short, in the process of making the marvelous and heartwarming discovery that outside the cities it is still 1958 in Australia. Hardly seems possible, but there you are. I was driving through my childhood. Partly it was to do with that dazzling light. It was the kind of pure, undiffused light that can only come from a really hot blue sky, the kind that makes even a concrete highway painful to behold and turns every distant reflective surface into a little glint of flame. Do you know how sometimes on very fine days the sun will shine with a particular intensity that makes the most mundane objects in the landscape glow with an unusual radiance, so that buildings and structures you normally pass without a glance suddenly become arresting, even beautiful? Well, they seem to have that light in Australia nearly all the time. It took me a while to recognize that this was precisely the light of Iowa summers from my boyhood, and it was a shock to realize just how long it had been since I had seen it. Partly, too, it was to do with the road. Almost all Australian highways are still just 2 lanes wide, and what a difference that makes. You're not cut off from the wider world as you are on a superhighway, but part of it, intimately connected. All the million details of the landscape are there beside you, up close, not blurred into some distant, tediously epic backdrop. It changes your whole outlook. There's no point in hurrying when all it's going to do is put you in the feathery wake of that old chicken truck half a mile ahead. Might as well hold back and enjoy the scenery. So there's none of that mad, pointless urgency. Gotta pass this guy, gotta keep pushing, gotta make some miles, that makes any drive on an interstate such an exhausting and unsatisfying business. When you come to a town on such a road, it is an event. You don't fly through at speed, but slow down and glide through, in a stately manner, like a float in a parade, slow enough to nod to pedestrians if you wish, and to check out the goods in the windows on Main Street. Oh, that's a good price on men's double-knit shirts, you observe in a thoughtful tone, or those lawn chairs were cheaper in Bathurst. For, needless to say, you are talking to yourself by now. Sometimes, quite often in fact, you stop for a coffee and a browse around the shops. Afterward, you return to the open road, and naturally at first you go a little too fast, for speed is an instinct, but then, whoops, you round a bend to find yourself fast approaching the back of a dump truck, kicking out smoke and laboring heavily up a slope. So you drop back and take it easy. You lean an arm on the windowsill, lay a finger on the wheel, and cruise. You haven't done this for years. You haven't been on a drive like this since you were a kid. You'd forgotten motoring could be fun. I loved it. As if to underscore the agreeably retro nature of the driving experience in Australia, I began to discover that radio stations in country towns specialize in songs from yesteryear. I don't mean songs from the 60s and 70s, but much earlier. This may be the last country in the world where you can turn on a car radio and stand a more than passing chance of hearing Peggy Lee or Julie London, possibly even Giselle McKenzie, whose popularity in the 1950s can only be attributed to a winning smile and the luck to live in an undiscriminating age. It would be intemperate to make a sweeping generalization about rural Australian radio stations, because I listened to no more than 6,000 or 7,000 hours of them in the time I was there, so I might have missed something good. But I will say this. When our modern monuments have crumbled to dust,
when the careless hand of time has worn away all traces of the 20th century, you can be certain that somewhere in an Australian country town there will be a disc jockey saying, "And that was Doris Day with her classic hit, Que Sera, Sera." I even loved that, too, for a week or so. And so, by such happy means, did I proceed through Lithgow, Bathurst, Blaney, and Lyndhurst, and finally, in mid-afternoon, fetched up in Cowra, a compact and tidy community of 8,207 people in the Lachlan Valley on the Lachlan River, both named, of course, for our dear old friend Mr. Macquarie. I knew nothing about Cowra, but I quickly learned that it is well known to Australians as the site of the infamous Cowra breakout. During World War II, a large prisoner of war camp stood just outside Cowra. One side held 2,000 Italian POWs, on the other were 2,000 Japanese. The Italians were model prisoners. Overcoming the mortification of finding themselves taken from the front lines and transported to a distant sunny land far from the roar of guns, they settled down and made the best of things. So gamely did they cover their disappointment that one might almost have thought they welcomed their new situation. They worked on local farms and were only lightly guarded. Their officers, I just love this, weren't guarded at all. They were free to come and go as they pleased, and asked only to close the door behind them to keep out the flies. Regularly they could be seen strolling into Cowra for cigarettes and newspapers, possibly an aperitif at the Lachlan Hotel. The Japanese presented a somber contrast. They refused to undertake work or offer any measure of cooperation. Most gave false names, so deep was the shame of capture. Ridiculously and tragically, in August 1944, in the middle of the night, 1,100 of them staged a suicidal mass breakout, bursting from their barracks with a bonsai cry and charging en masse at the guard tower, clutching baseball bats, chair legs, and whatever other weapons they could contrive. The startled guards poured bullets into the mass, but were quickly overwhelmed. Within minutes, 378 prisoners had escaped into the countryside. Quite what they expected to do out there is anyone's guess. It took 9 days to round them all up. The farthest any of them had gotten was 15 miles. The Japanese casualties were 231 killed and 112 wounded. The Australians suffered 3 killed that night, and a 4th during the hunt afterward. All this is commemorated in photographs and other displays at Cowra's Visitor Center, which in itself was excellent, but in a room at the back was a small audiovisual theater that was one of the most enchanting things I believe I've ever seen. Certainly ever seen in a small country town in the middle of nowhere. Behind glass on a kind of small stage were objects saved from the POW camp. Some books and diaries, a couple of frame photographs, a baseball bat and glove, a medicine bottle, a Japanese board game. As I entered, the lights automatically dimmed in the room. A little introductory music played, and then, this was the enchanting part, a young woman about 6 inches high stepped out of one of the frame photographs and began moving around among the objects and talking about Cowra in the 1940s and the prison breakout. My mouth fell open. She didn't just move about, but interacted with the objects. Stepped around books, idly leaned on a shell casing as she went through her presentation. As you can imagine, I got up and had a closer look, and I can tell you that no matter how close you got to the glass, and I had my head pressed up against it the way children do when they wish to be amusing, you couldn't see the artifice. She was a perfectly formed, full-color, charmingly articulate, rather dishy three-dimensional person, right in front of me, and only 6 inches high. It was the most captivating thing I had seen in years. It was obvious that it was a film projected in some way from beneath, but there wasn't a stutter or bump, no scratchy lines or wriggly hairs. It was as real as an image can get. She was a perfect little hologram. The narrative, it is worth noting, was sympathetic and informative, a model of its type. I watched it 3 times and couldn't have been more impressed. "Good, eh?" beamed a lady at the reception desk, seeing the amazed look on my face when I emerged. "I'll say." Anticipating my questions, she passed me a laminated card that explained how it was all done. The display was created by a company in Sydney, employing an optical trick that has been around for well over a century. It was all to do with projecting an image onto a glass plate, artfully positioned in such a way as to become invisible to the spectator. Beyond that, the only real trick was taking fastidious care
that the actress hit her marks exactly. It must have taken months. It was simply brilliant. And I will say this, when they figure out a way to get the little person to lap dance, they will make a fortune. I ended the day at Young, a farming town in plum and cherry country 40 miles down the Olympic Highway from Cowra, in the direction of Canberra. I got a room in a motel on a side street, not far from the town center. The owner, a fit-looking fellow in shorts and a short-sleeved shirt, read my name off the registration card and said, "G'day, Bill. Welcome to Young," and gave my hand a powerful shake, as if inducting me into a secret society. The friendliness of Australians, all of it quite sincere and spontaneous, as far as I could ever tell, never ceases to amaze or gratify. I had never had a motelier pump my hand before, or act so pleased that fate had thrown us together. "Glad to have you," he went on, still pumping away. "My name's Bruce," or whatever it was, for I was too disarmed, in every sense, to catch it. "Well, good day, Bruce," I stammered uncertainly. "I'm Bill." "Yes, Bill, we've established that," he said, and dropped my hand abruptly. "You're in room 6. I took my key to my room, opened the door, and stepped in. The room was, in every tiny particular degree, from 1958. I don't mean that it had not been decorated since 1958, or anything remotely disrespectful. I mean that inside that room it was 1958. The walls were paneled in knotty pine. The TV had a UHF dial on it. The toilet seat had been gift-wrapped with a sanitized-for-your-convenience wrapper. In a drawer in the bedroom were two complimentary postcards featuring views of the motel, and a paper bag into which I was urged, for my further convenience, to place unflushable objects. The bag bore a drawing of a woman, to tip us off, presumably, that it was intended for female personal things, rather than, say, corn cobs or small engine parts, and she could almost have passed for June Cleaver. I could not have been happier. I dumped my stuff and walked into town through the baking end-of-day heat. Now I saw the 1950s everywhere. Even the children crossing signs in Australia, I noticed, show kids in 1950s attire. A little girl in a party dress. A boy in short pants, like Dick and Jane in silhouette. Superficially, Young didn't look terribly much like the towns I had grown up with. The exceptionally wide streets, they love really wide streets in Australian country towns, the red tin roofs, the metal sidewalk marquees that run like hat brims around every commercial building, all this was indubitably Australian. But in the way it worked and what it contained, Young was uncannily familiar. This was a place where, when you had an errand to run, you drove into town, not out of it, and parked in an angled slot on Main Street. This alone was enough to hold me transfixed for some minutes. I had forgotten that there was a time when a little parking along Main Street was all a community needed. I walked around in a state of the profoundest admiration. Except for the banks and a supermarket, the businesses were locally owned, with all the peculiarities of taste and presentation that that implies. There were shops here of types I hadn't seen in years. Fix-it shops and little electrical shops, bakeries, cobblers, tea rooms, and sometimes they sold the most extraordinary combinations of goods. At the far end of the main street, I came across one place so exceptional in this respect that it stopped me in my tracks. It was a shop that sold pet supplies and pornography. I'm quite serious. I stood back to stare at the sign, then peered through the window and finally stepped inside. It was a smallish shop, and I was the only customer. On a raised platform about halfway back sat a man beside a cash register, reading a newspaper. He didn't say hello or make any acknowledgement, which seemed odd, very un-Australian, until I realized he was being discreet. I imagine most of his customers do what I was doing now, wander around showing an unwanted contemplative interest in catnip and flea powders, pausing from time to time to study the labels on canisters of fish flakes and the like, before ending up, entirely by accident, at the back of the shop, in the heavy breathing section. Remarkably, this is what happened to me now. The adult section was partitioned into a little compound, with admission through a wooden gate. As I stood there, the gate made a small electronic buzz, the kind of buzz that is made in office buildings when a door is opened from a remote location, and swung to in a provocative manner. I looked around, surprised. The man was still, to all appearances, absorbed in his newspaper.
He seemed unaware that I was even in his shop, much less on the threshold of porno heaven. I grinned foolishly and thought about approaching him to explain that he had just made a quite understandable but nonetheless comical error, that I, far from being a desperate pervert in need of pictorial nutrition,